Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Hop-Ons podcast, an Arrested Development review podcast sponsored by our Patreon supporters. My name is Colin Cox.
I'm John Phelps.
Buddy, it's good to see you tonight.
It's good to see you too, my friend.
So before we start, we should probably remind everyone, if you haven't taken an opportunity to rate and review the podcast, you should do that. This is a thing I do occasionally before we actually start the episode.
I think you've done it every episode so far.
I did not do it for the last episode.
Yeah, if you rate and review the episode, whatever you say in the review, we will say. So, you know, take that how you want. Please don't put terrible things in the review unless it's like, John, you're garbage or whatever.
Sure.
Don't say like racist things.
Please don't, but this is also important. We'll say it in the order that you write it, which I think is important.
Okay. Yeah, we will.
So
all right.
We are here to talk about Season 5, Episode 11, Chain Migration. This episode aired on March 15th, 2019, along with all of the second half of Season 5. John, this episode was 23 minutes long.
Yeah, and it felt like it was about 2,300 minutes long. See my joke?
I saw your joke. That was good.
23,000 minutes long. It felt as long as Amistad. How long is that? Because that's what this felt like.
Oh, the movie Amistad? Yes. Wait, so is that the one about Mozart, or is that the one
that's Amadeus?
By... Okay.
Amistad's the slave one.
Okay.
Jesus.
Because I like Amadeus.
Oh, I like Amistad too, actually.
John, this episode was written by Richard Day and directed by Troy Miller. The IMDb plot summary for this episode: as George Sr. attempts to win back Lucille, Michael assembles a mold of their scheme. Meanwhile, Buster gets caught up in Tobias and Job's business. So whoever wrote this, excellent use of a transitional word, meanwhile, that really helps to bridge those two sentences together.
Yeah, but this doesn't, that doesn't, do you think that's a good plot summary?
Well, it does have that transitional word.
Okay.
So I think...
All right.
But you seem to think that it's not.
It's not that. It's just the stuff with Buster and Tobias and Job is so insignificant compared to all the other George Sr. Oscar shit that happens in this
episode. No, I think that's fair. Yeah. Well, maybe that's why it comes second.
And the Michael stuff. He's in it for 3.5 minutes.
Michael is barely in this episode.
Yeah. So let's start with you. Before we hop into it, general thoughts on this episode.
I did not like this episode. I like it more the more I think about it, but it's not very funny.
I hate it more the more I think about it.
So Arrested Development purports to be a comedy, which is fine. That doesn't mean, and we talked about this last time, that doesn't mean every single moment needs to be funny, but some of the moments need to be funny.
There should be something funny. You are correct.
There should be an attempt at humor. It's really funny how in the last episode, we couldn't talk enough about how it seems as if Hurwitz was trying to pack every single moment, every breath, with something funny, ironic, layered jokes. And here, I don't know. This feels like a hangover the morning after.
Yeah.
An immense amount of alcohol consumption, but for this metaphor to work, jokes are alcohol, and we're the only one who's suffering, so I don't know how that works. John, I have the distinct impression that you also did not like this episode.
No, I did not like this episode whatsoever. It's one of those things where I watched it once, and I had a bad day at work, so I was like, I'll give it, you know, I'll watch it again and try to be more objective, and it is just not good. It's very boring. It's a very boring episode. And it feels a little, everything feels a little off to me about this episode. Maybe that's because last episode I really enjoyed. This episode, everything just feels like they don't know essentially what they're supposed to be doing, or, you know, and I want to say maybe this is a pivot episode, because whenever we have a bad episode, we go, it's a pivot episode. But I don't know if that's what this is.
Okay, so I don't think that's such a bad way to think about it. And it's funny, John and I, we think a lot alike, because I was thinking, if you're playing Hop-On's podcast bingo, John's about to say it's a pivot episode.
Yeah.
So you can go ahead and mark that square. But John, here's the thing. This is something of a pivot episode, because in the next episode, George Sr. and Lucille, they have that dinner with the Chinese, and that's an important plot point for this whole second half of season five. And Tobias living with Maybe for a bit of time, even though it's much smaller by comparison, that's also an important plot moment in this season. Sure. So there is something about this episode that tries to move the plot forward, which might help. And again, I've talked about this in particular, how with a sitcom, even though I think it's perhaps incorrect to describe Arrested Development as a sitcom at this point, I'm not sure what exactly it is, because that sitcom structure where problems are introduced in an episode and to varying degrees resolved by the end of the episode, even as they gesture towards a larger plot, that's just not this show any longer. Right. And I think it's quite visible in episodes like this how the show suffers when that doesn't happen, because while George Sr., Lucille, Oscar, I suppose, in varying ways are funny and interesting, they're only funny and interesting in relation to characters like Michael. Because, and tell me what you think about this, my favorite sequence of this episode is when Michael's interrogating Lucille and George Sr.
Oh, yeah.
That's a wonderful sequence. It just, again, reveals how essential a character like Michael is, and how, for some reason, when two characters are together, it just doesn't work as well as when that third character is there.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And Michael, this episode, you definitely miss Michael. And I would say George Michael. You miss them a lot. And it's interesting, you know, we've always talked about Michael kind of being the anchor for this show. And this episode definitely, you know, it displays that more than any episode in recent memory. That without Michael, it's kind of hard to get through sometimes.
It sometimes is. And at times, George Michael has emerged as a proxy for Michael.
A surrogate Michael.
A surrogate Michael. Yeah. So that's worth talking about as well, because you're right, we don't have either of them here.
Right.
And again, I think having those two characters helps to put the shenanigans of the rest of the family into a kind of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And you could even argue it provokes characters like Lucille, maybe George Sr., to attempt to justify their behavior. And I would argue there's nothing more entertaining in this show than when characters like Lucille try to justify the things she's done. And I think this is true of Job as well. Think about all of the wonderful scenes where Michael's just asking Job simple questions. Job, what's her name? And then Job just does what Job typically does. So without that intervention, the narrative really suffers, and the comedy suffers, and the dynamics suffer, and then we suffer.
Yeah, so let's talk about, and your very first point here is, the show opens at the mall, which we've never been to ever, have we?
We've been to a mall in season one or season two, when Job goes to buy mice. They're at a mall. Okay. Do you remember Tobias becomes a security guard?
Yeah, but
Lindsay
we don't.
Gets a job. But it doesn't
feel. There's
never
been this big grand opening shot of everything. And
there aren't establishing shots.
Right.
And we don't. It doesn't feel like a mall. It feels like a single room set.
So you like the mall as a set piece?
Well, I like malls.
I love malls. I'm a big people watcher, so I love going to malls. But I think the for me, why I didn't like this is because in this show, there have been so many real-life stores that are crazy. They have crazy names. They have crazy descriptions, crazy things going on. In this, we see none of that whatsoever. We see like an H&M, a T-Mobile, like actual stores that are in reality. And it just made me not happy. I was like, I don't want these people in my reality. Give me some fucking way. Because, you know, George Sr. says Buster's favorite stores there are Drink-A-Juice and Paint-A-Plate and Build-A-Bear. And I said, show me Drink-A-Juice. Just put a sign up for it. But instead, it's just, it feels like they had the lobby of a mall for an hour and said, just walk through there.
No, I think that's fair. And I think you're absolutely right. In season one, if someone said Drink-A-Juice, they would have cut to probably Buster in front of Drink-A-Juice with a 65-ounce cup of juice.
Yeah.
Think about what Buster trying to eat. I want to say a giant donut, maybe. In season one, he was standing on top of a restaurant.
Oh, right, right, right.
So he, again, these kinds of moments. And even when restaurants or stores that exist in our reality are in the show, they do fun and playful things with it, like Burger King, for example.
Yeah.
That's just, okay, Burger King will give us money to help produce this episode, and here's what we'll do with Burger King. It reminds me, in a show like 30 Rock, Snapple.
Oh, right.
They helped to produce the show. There are wonderful Snapple jokes. There's a wonderful Snapple sequence, maybe in season one or season two. And there's none of that here. I think you're absolutely right. I just like malls.
Well, I mean, I don't have any problem with that. It's just, I think that Troy Miller doesn't know how to shoot a mall. Because I will say, and this was a big, big deal for people. The ADR in this episode is horrendously bad. And this is the first time I've kind of felt it. And all the stuff in the mall is real bad ADR. And I think maybe that's why. It's just such a disconnect for me. And people were complaining, you know, before I watched it, I had a couple people reach out and say the ADR is terrible. And this is the first time I've really seen it. And it made me stop and go. And it's the whole episode. There's stuff in it. But all the mall stuff, it feels very disconnected, and maybe that's why I don't like it.
So can you talk a little more about what do you think Miller should have done differently to shoot a mall better? So because you're someone, we talked about this before, I can talk about film, but you're someone who's actually used cameras and produced video content. I have never done that, so I think you can talk about it in ways that I can't. What would you have done differently? What should he have done differently?
I mean, I don't think I would have used that huge establishing shot where it's just kind of them in a lobby of a mall and you can't really see anybody else. It feels very strange. The lighting, the way that shot looks like is like I took my cell phone and shot some people walking in a mall. And really, in all reality, I don't think any of that exposition, any of those shots were needed to show them in the lobby of the mall. Just show them walking beside stores or something, because that makes for more ADR, and then that in turn just makes everything feel more disjointed and disconnected. If you had them maybe like on a dolly shot walking beside them as they talked in front of stores and then end up in front of Tent City, I probably would have enjoyed that way more.
And this is why what you were saying right then, that's precisely why I like malls as set pieces, because filmmakers, if they are making something for predominantly an American audience, I would argue establishing shots are not necessary.
Right.
Because that mall, that's such a unique environment. Can you think of any other environment that feels like a mall? It's uniquely American in that way, just the sense of excess. And it feels a lot like old European bazaars as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But indoors, so there's this obvious sense of claustrophobia. Even if there are windows, we had a mall here in not Abingdon, Virginia, but Bristol, Virginia. My joke was always, yeah, it's really our dirt mall, but the problem is we don't have a good mall by comparison. We just have a dirt mall. There weren't really windows at all. There was no natural light. It felt very claustrophobic and gross in the best possible way.
Yeah, and I think that's the issue with the shots here. And also, there's an establishing shot outside of the mall of them going in.
And then there's another establishing shot inside the mall.
Yeah, we don't need that grandiose entrance. And that's what makes the ADR. And there were moments when Lucille and George Sr. are walking, and she's supposed to be talking, and none of the words match up to what she's saying.
It's really quite bad.
And it's very, very bad.
Right.
And I wasn't just trying to find it. I just noticed it.
Well,
you know?
Because that sort of thing, in all fairness, but I know what you mean, that's the sort of thing one might find, quite frankly, in any multicam sitcom.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of bad. We don't, because the pace is so quick, it's hard to notice unless someone rewatches, but there's a lot of bad ADR in a lot of multicam sitcoms. The problem here is you would think they could have done this better, and I don't know why this wasn't done better. Even though within the Tent City, I told you there's that one little camera move that Miller executes that I really liked, and it's this push and turn when Oscar and Buster are talking to that employee.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I think I would agree with you. Just a lot of odd shots. But again, I like moles. As yeah, just
I just pieces. Think technically maybe it was a little bit out of like Miller's wheelhouse. He's not into shooting giant sets. So
he's really not.
He just didn't know how to do it. I mean, he shot stuff with a lot of people, probably like the parade and the first half of this. I'm sure he shot one of those episodes. But here it's just technically maybe it was a challenge for him. And because I'm a snob, I noticed it.
Well, no, I don't think that makes you a snob. I think that makes you a discerning audience member. I think this is something I talk to my students about all the time. If you see something that doesn't suggest snobbery, that just suggests I can see choices that were made. Instead of just letting it wash over me, I can discern choices. Mm-hmm. And that puts someone in a position to discern bad choices or choices right. that could have been done better. Again, it is funny. That whole sequence, hearing you talk about it, it wouldn't surprise me if they were working with a very small amount of time because it all feels...
It's very rushed.
Incredibly rushed.
Yeah.
Okay, so, John, there's a lot of Keystone Cop references in this episode. Even when characters like Buster talk about himself and Oscar as, like, bandits or a group of
the inside-outside bandits.
The inside-outside bandits. Michael and George Michael are the Bluth Boys.
Yeah, and they have that great little silent film sped up montage, yeah, I guess you could say.
Exactly, and even Tobias refers to himself, Debris, and Murphy Brown as a
ragtag group.
As a ragtag group of would-be actors. What's with all of these references?
I don't know. I think Hurwitz just starts with one, and he's like, let's work some more in, and that's how it always is okay. with this show. I think one of my favorite parts in this episode, even though I wasn't a big fan of the episode, is the silent film thing with George Michael and Michael. I thought it was very funny. And again, they've been able to work that into like every episode since the parade. They've had some kind of silent film-esque
some kind of reference
feel to something.
Yeah, to a silent film aesthetic. I mean, the only thing I can think is Hurwitz trying to suggest that if you don't like this show or if you're displeased with seasons 4 and 5, it's because you fundamentally don't understand the aesthetic sensibilities that he's interested in trafficking in.
Yeah.
Because when you just describe Arrested Development as not a sitcom or a comedy, but as really just a goofy silent film, like a Charlie Chaplin film, mm-hmm. that helps to explain a lot of the chicanery in this show.
Sure.
Because it's not meant to make sense in the same way that a lot of silent films don't always make sense. There's that disjointed feeling between what you're seeing and what you understand, because there's visual image and then there's text and visual image and then text. So it's a very disruptive viewing experience. And I think for a lot of people, especially people who really like this show, they would say Season 5 in particular at times was disruptive as just a viewing experience.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. What are your thoughts on, and we'll just skip a little bit because I wanted to talk to you about this. What are your thoughts on Dusty as a character?
Okay, so I wanted to do a bit of compare and contrast work. Can we talk about Dusty in relation to Marky Bark? Because, boy, isn't it interesting how, again, even though the particulars are a bit different, Dusty feels a bit like Marky Bark in some ways.
I don't think he's nearly as endearing or
goofy. Okay.
I don't like Dusty. That's what I'll say. I get what they're going for, but I think that, and again, this could just be, you know, nitpicking, but there's something off about him as a character, and I'm not sure if it's as, like, aesthetically, the wig looks really bad, so that always throws me off, but I just don't get what he's doing. I don't understand.
So Dusty has more time in the rest of season 5.
Right.
But hearing you say there's something almost tilted about this character because he doesn't seem straight. There's something odd about him.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. But he does have a wonderful line. What's your business on the beach, bro?
Yeah, the Newport boy, the Newport.
They are the Newport Bay Boys.
Newport Bay Boys. And they whip rocks at people.
Again, a makeshift gang of individuals.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
See what I
Very
mean?
West it's Side just, Story.
I know.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of Dusty, but it seems like maybe you like him.
So I do.
Right.
For, well, because I've watched the entire season, so I know what they do with this character. He feels like a Bluth in so many interesting ways, which helps to complicate this incest and the incestuous nature of this family, that not only are they incestuous toward one another, but they seem to seek people who are not so dissimilar from themselves and really incorporate them into the horror that is this family. But he's just weird.
Yeah, he is. He's very weird.
And I like how, again, even though I think the particulars are clearly different, just seeing that Lindsay and Lucille have a type, it seems, a kind of earthy.
Okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Grunged, again, not entirely mature white man child person.
Okay. Yeah. There's a chance in future episodes I will like him, but right now the taste in my mouth is not a very good one.
It's not a good
regarding
taste.
Dusty.
Yeah, well, it's not a good episode.
It seems like Dusty is just used. I'm not sure how. That's how I felt like in this episode. They just said, oh, let's do something. Like with Oscar and George Sr., they both had this plan to keep Buster thinking he's in prison or escape from prison, even though they don't give a shit about him. They're happy that he's out. Just so Oscar can spend more time with him, and George Sr. thinks that will help him bond more with Lucille.
Boy, what a convoluted narrative.
It's stupid, and
I'm sorry, that's so convoluted.
It's really dumb. And at one point, it just hit me when they're in the dressing rooms talking to each other. There is hardly anything anymore that delineates those two people, and I thoroughly hate that, because Oscar in season one?
We met Oscar in season one, but he emerged as a significant secondary character in season two.
And he was so good. He had
his
very
funny.
Own persona, and I loved Oscar. Nothing like that anymore.
John, I completely agree. Because they were cast as foils for one another, and now I think you're right. They're just not just in appearance, but even in personality, just utterly indiscernible.
Yeah.
And because I think gesturing towards fairness is important, I don't think this is as much Tambor's fault as it is just the writing of these characters.
Oh, no, I agree. Yeah.
Because he has a moment, again, I realize it's perhaps not popular to say anything positive, but he has a moment in the tent when he, in effect, tells Buster, I've really cherished all of this. That's a subtle, and he's making a series of subtle choices. Mm-hmm. And he feels a bit like Oscar in that moment, but I agree. Otherwise, I could not tell them apart based on the things they say and how they behave, because they seem utterly indistinguishable at this point.
And it was happening in season four, obviously, but...
And it started to happen near the end of season three, really.
They really should, at some point, they should have let Oscar grow his hair back, and they should have let him be, you know, a lot more of like that free spirit hippie that he was, which would be great if he showed up and Dusty was there and Lucille was like, who do I choose between? Because he's got that hair and I love that hair.
Well, I think
that's
part of what's
interesting
about...
But now it makes sense why she likes Dusty. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the hair. But even Oscar, when's the last time you saw Oscar smoke pot?
Oh, yeah. And the only difference now is he wears black rimmed glasses.
That's
and
the only
George
difference.
Senior wears gold rimmed glasses. Yeah. They're the exact same person. It's irritating.
Just all the times that Oscar was just high as fuck.
It was great.
And saying weird shit. But
that's
now,
what I needed in
I
my
know.
Life.
I completely agree with
like
you.
Like when he sells the lemon trees and he's just like that piece of shit relative that you have that talks in weird second language. So you're like, maybe he grifted me. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he doesn't know he did. And now he's just...
Well, even when we meet him and he continues to pass gas...
Yeah, it's so good.
I think that was the espresso machine.
And now it's just...
you're high, you're drunk.
Maybe they're trying to mature him, quote-unquote, as a character, but I wish they wouldn't, you know?
Well, part of this, again, it's residue from certain choices they made in season four, where they in effect they Freaky Friday'd these
but it's two but characters. That's over now. He's not taking the mock anymore.
Yeah,
none of that matters anymore. It should be over now.
Well, it should be, but it seems as if it's not. It's as if whomever's writing the show completely forgot that that's a choice they made.
Yeah, I feel bad talking about this episode, but it is quite boring.
So, John, do you like the Golden Girls?
Yeah, no, that joke did... It made me laugh the first time. And then the second time, I just stopped and went, why is
well,
this...
I can't answer why, but...
It is funny. It's funny.
That's... Tobias has a line.
He's looking.
We're just three 56-year-old women looking for a place to rest our weary asses. Oh, fuck.
Yeah, and then I like that DeBree's name is Mrs. Jean Betty White. That's so stupid.
So what's Murphy Brown's character's
Bev.
Name?
Bev.
God, the way he says that.
Bev, Mrs. Featherbottom, Mrs. Jean Betty White. What a ridiculous situation.
Well,
but it made me laugh. I mean, it's exactly what they should do.
When you think about the idea that Mrs. Featherbottom even exists.
Which Mrs. Featherbottom is fantastic, but I think I hate the pink mustaches.
Boy, I'm so tired of that.
Didn't he shave the mustache in as Mrs. Featherbottom? Or he did, right?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he did. That'd have been way better.
But now he just doesn't.
Now I'm just, again, this is how bad this episode is. I'm talking about his fucking mustache. But that scene with Maybe, again, she's very sinister. She more or less wants to
gaslighting
abuse Stan Sitwell.
It's not
and
just so she's
she is
physically
him, yeah.
abusing him, and she is psychologically and emotionally abusing him because she is gaslighting him.
Yeah.
In the same way that Lucille gaslit Michael in mm-hmm. season one. She's becoming Lucille.
You're absolutely right.
Which is horrifying to think about.
Because Maybe has... Well, I mean, I was going to say that, but Lucille's still very villainous and has her wits about her when she wants to. Not regarding this whole wall situation, which we need to talk about in a second. But I think that the Maybe storyline is very silly, but I'm still here for it. I enjoy it. I like any time she's on screen, pretty much.
Well, again, Aaliyah Shawkat is quite good.
Yeah.
She's quite funny in this episode, even though, again, things we like about season five. We like Michael.
Yeah.
We like George Michael. We like the fake block dynamic. We like Maybe. They're not really in this episode. And, oh, we like Job, because
and
Job is wonderful as everything.
4 seconds, but he's great.
But he's only at the end, and he has a scene in the bumpers. Yes. So all of the things that really work in these latter two seasons are not in this episode.
Yeah, that should explain, I guess, how we feel pretty much.
I think so. Oh, I meant to ask you, so what's the name of the actor who plays Dusty?
Dermot Mulroney.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, Robot, if I'm wrong, please correct me.
Yeah, Robot, check.
What? No, I think it's... No, you're right, John.
Okay. Oh boy, Robot sounds strange.
Robot, are you drunk, Robot?
What's happening to Robot? Anyway, we need to talk to her. So, John, one last thing, we should talk about Job. So,
no, before we talk about Job, we will discuss the wall.
God damn it!
We should rename this episode, this whole podcast, to "We Will Discuss the Wall" in every fucking episode.
I'm just terrified of what that might do to our ratings and reviews.
So, it might go up, actually.
That's
let's talk about how none of this makes fucking sense. And at one moment, when Michael comes in and he's like, aha, his aha moment with his tongue model, which was very funny. He's got a model of the wall. It's on a tongue. And he's talking about, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to understand it. I'm going to get it. Nope.
I understand it even less.
I have no fucking idea. They and here's the even weirder part is that they essentially wanted Michael to sell his houses that no one's using, maybe sexual predators, we don't know.
Oh, I think they moved out.
Okay, so no one's using. They want Michael to sell that.
Well, Michael
to seems get the to... money to give them to give to the Chinese.
Wait, Michael seems to think that's what they want, but do they actually confirm that's what they want?
That's all they have. Remember last episode, George Sr. even says it. We own Sudden Valley.
So, but okay. But they don't confirm it. But you think Michael's suspicions are correct?
Yes. I think that these people are fucking idiots. That's what I think. And they think that there's money somewhere in Michael's shitty land development, which, let's say he did sell it. How much could he get for it? And also, what do they even owe the fucking Chinese? We don't know. We know nothing. We know nothing. I'm Jon Snow. I know nothing. It is so bad. And that's all I have to say. That's all we're talking about the wall this episode.
Okay, great. So I don't want to talk about this. I am saying nothing about the wall. If you have thoughts about the wall, please email them to us.
Please. Anything. Somebody out there has to work on walls for a living. Just tell me what the fuck they're doing. Somebody has to do it, right? There's got to be someone out there.
Well, I don't necessarily know if someone who someone has to know what this is.
Someone has had to like has pulled a whiteboard out and has gone through and tied the red string around and they have to know what this is.
Sure, send us a picture of the red string.
Because if I don't find out before this is over, I'm going to jump off a bridge. So,
well,
that's where we're at right now. It's this shitty MacGuffin. Anyway, let's talk about Job.
So, Job, he's because. This episode, to its credit, it at least gives us a sense of how quick everything's happening because, in theory, Job just left his conversation with Argyle.
Same day as the previous episode.
Same day, exactly. So, Job, he has this body. He asks Buster to dispose of it for him. Mm-hmm. And he then goes to gay conversion therapy.
Correct.
And this episode seems to argue that it works.
Well, he's supposed to, if I'm not mistaken, the gay mafia wants him to go and say it didn't work and continue to be gay until he ages out, quote unquote.
Correct.
He sits down to fill out the papers. He sees Anne's mom's breasts and immediately gets a big old boner.
In a sweater.
What? And then he has to walk out. He has to do the boner walk out of there, the boner walk of shame, which was great.
Yes.
But yes, so I don't know what's going to happen now with the gay mafia. I don't care, but we are led to assume now, which kind of, you know, confirms our suspicions that he maybe was not for Tony Wonder the whole time. He just didn't have a friend, as it might have been stated from the outset.
It's possible, but then again, we talked about this last time. I don't necessarily know, because even Michael, as early as season one, seemed to suggest that Job's sexual orientation is not so easy to plot on a gay, straight, binary.
It's real pan, I would assume.
Yeah, and so I'm sympathetic to the idea, even though, regrettably, I don't know if Hurwitz handles it as deftly as he should, but that seems to be, at least that's the charitable reading, that's what Job may have learned, mm-hmm. that he's still attracted to women.
Oh, I just got it. I got why he got the boner. Not because of the breasts, because he saw the cross. He saw the tea and thought about Tony. I just got that.
Well, but then he said he wants to take her sweater off.
I don't think so. I think it's because of Tony.
It could be both.
You're right. It could be both.
She's an attractive woman. That Whoville.
Yeah, but he's great. And I like that in his scene before that, he plays the straight man to Buster's kind of craziness.
Yeah,
and
really
it's actually really funny. Buster at that point, I think hopefully has registered that he is not in prison any longer because Job was very matter of fact about it.
He was. You would like to think that Buster isn't that delusional.
And Buster wants to keep it going even though he's not sure if he believes it or not.
Because he enjoys spending time with Oscar as well. Again, if we're thinking about all of these references to gangs and Bluth Boys and these little groups, these little communities. Again, it's perhaps suggesting that characters on this show are desperately searching for some kind of unification. They don't they don't want to continue working exclusively as these disconnected individuals. Mm-hmm. So that's perhaps what it feels like to me. Hurwitz moving towards that moment at the end when everyone's back together again. So, but anyway, final thing about Job. Yeah, I would like to think that what Job learned, but it's difficult to know if Job can ever learn anything, is that he is perhaps best defined as someone who is pansexual.
Yeah, absolutely.
And again, I just don't know if Hurwitz is the right person to execute that kind of a delicate point.
Right. He's not. No.
Maybe not. John, I'm trying to look at my notes and see if there's anything else I want to talk about. I think that's everything.
If this is your first time listening to the Hop On's podcast, we have way better episodes than this one. So try to find those because this episode is just boring. And
well, but that's not
I hope that fault. We weren't boring, but there's not a lot to talk about.
No, there's not.
The whole episode is just based around George and Lucille, and that's it.
That's true.
And we have some other members scattered in there, but for the most part, it's George trying to ignite his marriage back with Lucille, which I don't care about that. And because of what happened in the real world with Jessica Walter and Jeffrey Tambor, I could care even fucking less about that.
And it's interesting to hear you say that because even the narrator at times, the way he describes George Sr.'s motivations seems to suggest that he's deeply suspicious and not terribly interested in this narrative as well, which, again, if we're thinking what are the variety of ways that the narrator functions in the show, one might be as a kind of Greek chorus who right. suggests how we should read certain characters, certain character arcs, and I think his disgust with George Sr.'s motivations should give us a map of sorts, a paradigm to understand what's frustrating about what he's ultimately trying to do.
Yeah, it's a good way to look at it,
I think so. Well, John, we can talk about something else to fill the time. So you haven't seen Meet Joe Black.
We're not going to talk about that. Let's just move on to our segments, and then we'll hop in maybe to something at the end for those patient listeners, and we will not be talking about Meet Joe Black.
If you like Meet Joe Black, tweet at me. John, let's start with our first segment. The Banana Stand Award. Who is the craziest blue?
Oh, this one's hard for this. I guess we could say maybe. I mean, she, again, is gaslighting an old man to keep a free rental property.
I don't know why.
And
I think she enjoys it, too.
I have to choose her. Everybody else, Job is trying to hide a body, but I don't know if that is as crazy as maybe. I'm going to say maybe.
Okay. I'll say Tobias.
Okay.
So they're living in a tent city, and then he hears that maybe has a living space in a retirement community. So Tobias thinks, okay, let me find my Mrs. Featherbottom costume, and I'll find costumes for the I'll find costumes for these other two jabronis, and then we'll just go, and that's what we'll do.
Right.
So I'll say Tobias.
Okay.
Well, John, second segment, Top Banana Bar. And if you are joining us for the first time, the way this segment works, we rate each episode on a scale from 1 to 5. But 3 represents the season 1 episode Top Banana. So, and we choose Top Banana because we think that is a good Arrested Development episode.
Correct.
It embodies what we think is essential about this show. So if we think an episode is higher than 3, we think it's maybe a little bit better.
A little bit better than your average episode.
Exactly. If we think it's less than 3, then it needs to do a little bit of work.
Correct.
John, be gentle.
I'm going to say 1 on this episode. It's just not good. And that's all. Listen, the previous things I said, it's a 1.
I'll say a 1 too. I don't like this episode.
Yeah.
Okay, John, best lines.
Oh, I have a few. Drink a juice and paint a plate. We already said that. Those are very funny. I don't actually have that many. Now I'm looking at it. We're really bonding over this we miss our son bullshit. That's a George Sr. line. Again, a lot of just straight mean stuff in this episode. I'm not really sure why they do that. this is a great Lucille line. She says, I think I could eat a piece of fish without giving away how much I loathe you. Talking about George Sr., which that was really funny. George Sr. says, could you tell Lucille I died doing something that looked fun? Talking about being in the water ball. Go ahead.
Okay. I have more than you. Now, admittedly, he's not 28 anymore. That's a George Sr. line. We got to get you out of the food court. That's a George Sr. line. Buster was missing, and George Sr. was eager to make it look like it was something he cared about. That's a Ron Howard line. Realistically, I could sniff out Mother somehow, but she wouldn't want me. That's a Buster line. And we're really bonding over this missing our son bullshit. Yep. Okay, so this is a Tobias line, maybe the best line in the episode. Well, that sounds like a challenge to any family that wasn't a ragtag troupe of folks who might wish to become actors. We're just three 56-year-old women looking for a place to rest our weary asses. They had met when George, after a failed attempt at ocean balling to impress his wife, gerbled up to the beach.
Gerbled.
That had been under the domain of a surf gang called the Newport Bay Boys. What's your business on the beach, brah? Those stairs are just for the feet of the Bay Boys.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
That's a nice, dusty, dusty line. Oh, that voice. Shrillery.
Shrillery. So ridiculous.
Okay, no, maybe this is the best. It's not a line, but it's an exchange between Michael and Lucille. This generation, they go to one therapy session and all of a sudden their parents are terrible people because they once sold tract homes to God even remembers now, Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, that was actually very funny.
Okay, so this is a Job and Veal's mother exchange. Who? That's the one.
Yeah, that's a great little thing.
That's a tomorrow job. That's for the daytime. That's an Oscar line. John, callbacks and running jokes. Blue's living in the attic. Mrs. Featherbottom, Buster's hand. Buster as a murder suspect slash monster because mm-hmm. he gets a little weird at times. Building homes for Saddam Hussein. Oscar as Buster's father. Tony Wonder's death conspiracy. And Job's sexuality.
I actually have one more line I forgot about.
Okay.
Buster says, I'm a wanted man. And then Job, because he's perfect, says, well, that's impossible. You weren't even a wanted child.
Oh, and I forgot to include Blues not knowing Veal family members' names.
Oh, yeah.
Or confusing their names. So, John, that's our conversation for season 5, episode 11, Chain Migration. Before we migrate out of this horrible episode, is there anything new happening on the Nice Marmot Production YouTube page?
Yeah, I just put up a recap and review for season 8, episode 1 of Game of Thrones. And it's very funny. You should check it out. How about the Cluttered Desk podcast?
Can you stop talking about penises so much?
It's impossible.
Clearly. No, nothing new because we finished season 8. It's entirely possible that as an interstitial episode, we'll talk about one of those Avengers movies because there's a new one.
Yeah, just the biggest one that's ever come out. Yes, it is.
So they say.
So they say, yes. It's going to be a big, big, big deal.
Well, for my money, you can't top Thor 2. I don't.
That one's garbage. We have so much time left. Would you like to talk for a second about your thoughts, if you're not a fan of this, then fast forward like 5 minutes, on Game of Thrones?
Oh, I like this idea that there is this existential crisis that everyone, to varying degrees, has tacitly acknowledged is real,
mm-hmm.
right? Yet, all of the petty interpersonal dynamics that in many ways defines this show, everyone's just right back in it. And
yeah,
that's such an interesting...
It is.
That's such a... Because you could imagine why everything to this point was just riddled with those sorts of soap operatic interpersonal dynamics because no one really believed the existence of these White Walkers, mm-hmm. this symbolic existential threat. But now everyone gets it. And all they can do is throw shady eyes at one another because, oh, you didn't welcome me the right way. And I'm thinking, all of you idiots, you're just so stupid. But it's such an interesting bit of commentary, I would argue, just about the human condition and how even in the face of an existential threat, we will resort to these petty interpersonal dynamics. Mm-hmm. It's that I really like.
It's all but Jon Snow, who literally every time somebody brings something up about Daenerys and her army is like, I did this so we could live, you stupid sons of bitches.
I know. Well, so if we're just using contemporary political analogies, there are just times when I think, so Jon Snow, he's like the AOC of Westeros, where everyone else is just mired in these petty political fights, and he's just shouting, no, the world is ending. We need to do something about it. Shut up.
Shut up. I want to serve you, dumbass, not her. Anyway, I was very happy about it, and I'm excited to see where they go. Yeah.
Yeah, I am too. Bran is weird.
It's a great place to end the podcast on. Bran is very, very strange, and he stares quite a lot.
I was thinking he would be perfect in the Milford School.
Oh, he would be the top student in that school.
Well, you see, this is what you don't learn, because they don't show us this in the recap. Between season 7 and 8, he did a summer semester at the Milford School.
He probably did.
Which is why he's so good at remaining quiet and staring awkwardly at people.
There's this great moment in the first episode when Sansa and Tyrion have this like back and forth, and it's really cold, but maybe there's like some affection there. And then like the camera's on Tyrion's face, and like it just turns down, and Bran's just like dead eyes staring right at him for no reason. Literally for no reason, he's just staring at him, and it like just lingers.
Well, there are these moments when I think, wait, so are we led to believe that those moments with Bran, it's like someone's doing a mockumentary of a Game of Thrones episode, and those are the moments when they inserted it where Bran's just staring awkwardly at someone. It's so fourth wall breaking.
It's very strange.
In such an interesting way. I don't know. Because here's what I'm thinking. Okay, so I get it. Perhaps the point they're trying to suggest is that Bran is becoming increasingly detached
from mobile conversation. He's also all-knowing, all-seeing.
Exactly. So he's experiencing a kind of transcendence in the same way that Dr. Manhattan in Watchmen experiences a similar sort of transcendence. But there's a way of framing that so that it just doesn't feel silly. And I don't understand how you're editing this and not thinking, so that looks a bit silly, right?
Oh, and the cuts are comedic. We watched it together, and every time we all laughed. I mean, it would be like right after a very serious moment, and then it was like a comedic cut to Bran just like dead-eye. We just died laughing.
This is what I mean. So either someone is grossly incompetent and doesn't understand how editing works, or this was intentional. And if this is intentional, what the hell? Because listen, Game of Thrones, what you think about it, I can't say obviously what everyone thinks about it, but I think at times it's a surprisingly funny show.
Oh yeah, times. I would agree with that.
But that's certainly not the main tonal sensibility of this show. When it's funny, it's almost unintentionally funny, or it's funny in ways that maybe at times Arrested Development is funny, where characters are poking and prodding at one another.
Right.
But this is just, this again, it's like a cut to Buster wearing a shirt that matches the wallpaper, stare, just pushing his head out and pulling it back. It's funny in that way, which doesn't, that's just not a sensibility that really works with this show. I think it's funny, but I don't know if that's what they intended. So anyway, but listen, John, for the Hop-Ons podcast, my name is Colin Cox.
I'm John Phelps.
Buddy, I'll talk to you next time.
Okay.